From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. God is simple. Everything else is complex. At least that's how one philosopher put it. Someone should tell the rest of the world. Getting tangled up in the world's religions is easy to do. But maybe finding common ground isn't so hard. Just look at Abraham.
He's the father of all three religions. That means he is the father of 12 million Jews, 2 billion Christians, and 1 billion Muslims around the world. Half the humans alive today. And yet, we know almost nothing about him.
Bruce Feiler sheds light on Father Abraham in just a moment. And later on, a former nun leaves the convent in search of the Black Madonna. And Booker Prize-winning novelist Jan Martel talks about the faith behind his extraordinary book, Life of Pi.
If people come to it with an open mind, if they read it carefully, letting the words sink in, it may very well be the story to make you believe in God.
Finding understanding between Christians and Muslims, Muslims and Jews, Jews and Christians, well, it's never been simple. But today, the differences between the religions of the world feel like a keg of dynamite that could explode at any minute. It's a good time, then, to think about Abraham. Abraham is a central figure to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It's also the title of Bruce Feiler's book, The Story That Gives New Meaning to a Dusty Figure from the Scriptures. Feiler says one thing most people can agree on is the power of Abraham's story.
The most mesmerizing story of Abraham's life is his decision to nearly sacrifice his son to God. Each of us in our own traditions has a relationship with that story. But you would think in some way that that story was so barbaric, it would have died out over time. Instead, Jews read that story in their holiest week of the year, at Rosh Hashanah. Christians read that story, the same story, in their holiest week of the year, at Easter. And Muslims read that story, the same story, in their holiest week of the year, at the end of the pilgrimage. So here he is, not only just the father, but an active presence and an important element in every religious conversation today, 4,000 years after he would have lived. And I think you're right in saying that we're so focused on our own traditions to see his role across the world does come as something of a surprise.
Well, let's talk about that story for a moment, because while it is common to all three, it is also a source of dispute among the three. I noticed you very carefully said Abraham almost sacrificed his son without using the name of his son. In Jewish and Christian tradition, it is Isaac. But that's not necessarily true in Islam, is it?
Well, I think that here we begin to see what I think has become the great underlying story and becomes the heart of the story that I uncovered when I went looking for Abraham. And that is that in the original story itself, there is, I think, a clear message of unity. God chooses Abraham to be his partner. God blesses Abraham and blesses both of his sons, Ishmael, who is the firstborn son who comes from Hagar, the maid of Sarah, and Sarah's son, Isaac. Even after that moment when Sarah forces Abraham to kick Ishmael into the desert, which we should say here is tantamount to killing him, God continues to bless both of them. And then comes the moment where he's asked to sacrifice the second son. And Genesis 22 says, God says, take your son, your favored one, Isaac, whom you love, and take him up to the altar and offer him as a burnt offering. Okay, and that, as we all know, Abraham takes Isaac up there. The angel says, don't do it. And at the last moment, Isaac is saved. That story appears in Genesis 22 and then drops out of the Hebrew Bible. None of the prophets refer back to it. Disappears. It begins to reemerge about 1,500 years later, a couple hundred centuries before Christ is born, when Jews are beginning to feel oppressed, and they go back to that moment. But they're not looking at Abraham. They're looking at Isaac, and they're saying, look, just as he had to suffer, then we have to suffer. Along comes Christianity. And they go back to the story for a different reason. They see all these parallels with Jesus. Okay, so they say, well, look, Isaac carries his own wood just as Jesus carries his wood to the altar. The ram comes out of the bush in the same way that Jesus wears a crown of thorns. And so they say that, look, this story is a precursor of the story of God sacrificing his son, Jesus. And then Jews say, well, wait a minute, we're not going to take that sitting down, to use a modern phrase. They say, well, actually, Abraham took Isaac up there and he did kill him. And Isaac went away for 3 days, came back, and that's why the angel had to call out a second time. And I think this idea was so popular in the Middle Ages that Jews actually put ashes on their foreheads to commemorate the death of Isaac.
Now, is that same thing true? Is that same use of tradition and interpretation true in the story as it is told in Islamic tradition?
Even more so, because the Quran tells the story, retells the story, but does not name the son, which is not surprising because it sort of alludes back to the Bible but doesn't retell them. So there was a big battle in Islamic interpretations. Which son was it? About half the Muslim interpreters said it was Isaac, because that's what Genesis says. And the other half said, well, let's go back and look. It says, Abraham says, take your son, your favored one. Well, why does he have to say twice which son? And then he says Isaac. And then he says, whom you love, as if Abraham, once he hears it's Isaac, isn't sure that what he feels toward Isaac is love. And so these Islamic interpreters, some of them, said, well, look, clearly it's Ishmael that God's referring to. And Jews and Christians, in an attempt to alter the text because they felt jealous of Ishmael, they inserted Isaac's name there. And so this camp said it was Ishmael. So you got an Ishmael camp and an Isaac camp. They were rivalrous for a couple hundred years. And then over time, as Islam grows more powerful and wants to distance itself from Judaism and Christianity, the Ishmael camp prevails. And again, there you see, I think, what is the basic element of the story, which is a tension between the message of the story and what the religions have interpreted and said that message is over time.
These are things that help define for us the moments at which the religions began to divide, but they don't look at what the problems are between the religions so much. It seems to me that it's later when scholars in each tradition began to look not just at ways in which they are unique, but in which others are wrong.
Well, I think, and that's one of the fascinating things about Abraham, is you can see in his life story each of the religions using him as a prod. I mean, early in Judaism, they say that Abraham is a universal figure because God in Genesis 12 says that he will bless those who bless Abraham, curse those who curse him, and all the families of the earth shall be blessed. But over time, as Jews began to feel oppressed, they began to say, well, wait a minute, we want to keep Abraham for ourselves. So suddenly Abraham becomes the reason for Passover, which came with Moses, who lived 1,000 years later. Abraham even starts keeping kosher, the rabbis say, even though the laws of kosher weren't invented until 2,000 years after. So Jews first, because Judaism came first, they feel somewhat insecure, and therefore they want Abraham not to be the universal figure, but to buttress their own faith. And then Christians do the same thing. In the early years of Christianity, Paul says Abraham is a universal figure. But over time, as Christians grow more powerful, they then want to distance themselves from Judaism, and they say, well, God didn't call Abraham to go forth in Genesis 12. Jesus called him to go forth. God didn't promise the land to descendants of Abraham, but to followers of Jesus. So they begin to turn him into a Christian, and then Muslims do the same thing. Muhammad, in the early years, says Abraham's a universal figure. He shouldn't just belong to Jews and Christians, but to Muslims as well. But over time, as Islam grows more powerful, again, they distance themselves from their cousins, as you suggested, and they say, well, Abraham prefers Ishmael to Isaac. He even calls the pilgrimage. He even, in Muslim tradition, builds the Kaaba, that big black stone that Muslims walk around in the middle of Mecca. So they then turn him into a Muslim, and that becomes really, I think, less an expression of Abraham than an expression of how the religions relate to one another.
As you've looked around in modern times, looking for the history of Abraham in each tradition, do you find in each a recognition of that reinterpretation of the past?
Well, that really is the key question. And I think that the answer to that question is that that is where the smart people on this topic are today. One morning I was in East Jerusalem and I trekked into this dark room with whitewashed walls. And about 10:45, a broad-shouldered man came in. His name was Sheikh Yusuf Abu Snaina. He's the Imam of Al-Aqsa. It's the third holiest mosque in Islam. He actually had this dark hair and this beard, and he actually reminded me, against my will, of Ayatollah Khomeini. But he was also nervous because he had never spoken to a Western reporter before. And we had exactly the same conversation that we're having today. And he started off very stiff and said Abraham loved God. He submitted himself to Allah. We should try to be like him. And over time, we talked about the pilgrimage, and then we approached the exact question you just asked me. And I asked it to him, and I said, look, given all the events in the world, how can I not feel despair? Or can the spirit of Abraham prevail? And he said, if Jews, Christians, and Muslims follow what's mentioned in the text, then we can reach unity. But we have two different texts, I said. But the message is the same, he said. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to believe that, but I live in New York. People are flying planes into buildings. How can I not feel sadness? You should feel sadness, he said, but still, hope must endure. And his eyes burned, and you could see he was a preacher. He was a leader. Abraham was a man of faith, he said. He invented monotheism. If we look beyond the details, which we disagree about, and focus on the principles of Abraham, truth, morality, and coexistence, then most of our problems will disappear. And he finished with his flourish and stood up, and we shook hands, and I considered embracing him, but stopped short. He said we could focus on the message. It seemed like enough of an embrace.
Isn't it a little frightening, though, to have to go that far back in the tradition of any of these faiths to find a figure who can bring them together? I mean, how many thousands of years ago is it that Abraham is supposed to have lived?
He would have lived about 4,000 years ago. And actually, no, I'm not sure that I agree with that question, because I think that sometimes the best way to understand the present is by turning away from the present and turning back to the past. And when you go back to the story of Abraham, you realize that at the heart of it, it really is a family feud. Now, we know family feuds are bloodier and deadlier than other feuds, but we also know that we have a vocabulary in our own lives for having family conversations. And if you cast it in that light and you begin to build what we have in common, I think it helps us to deal with what we have that divides us. Because I don't think, the important thing is the goal here is not one religion. It's not some Esperanto mumbo jumbo where we all hold hands and dance kumbaya around the campfire. The destination is a place where we can respect the difference, and she has her religion and he has his religion and I have my religion, and we just mutually coexist. And I think going back and seeing how we got here, understanding that Abraham really provides the roadmap, I think begins to allow us to see Abraham as the roadmap for where we go from here.
Bruce Feiler is the author of Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths. He also created what he calls Abraham Salons, which are grassroots interfaith conversations that begin by studying Abraham. Coming up, a boy and his tiger take a leap of faith, and a writer finds his.
I started going to church just to see exactly what exactly do these Catholics do every Sunday.
But first, the road to peace in the Middle East. Father Abuna Elias Shakur is a Christian, a Palestinian, an Arab, and an Israeli citizen. He saw the destruction and hatred springing up from the Arab-Israeli conflict and decided to do something about it. So he started an interfaith school, which grew into the Mar Elias Interfaith Institutions, which educate students up to 50 years old. Teachers at the school are Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, and the students are just as diverse. Shakur told Steve Paulson that as complicated as the Arab-Israeli conflict is now, for everyone there is a simple beginning.
I was not born a Christian or a Palestinian, Arab, or Israeli citizen. I was born, imagine, a baby on the image of the likeness of God. And all religions should aim at helping us human beings to rediscover our original identity of having been born a baby on the image of the likeness of God, which means with the dignity, with the self-esteem, with the rights, with the vision, with the dreams of a baby born on his image with his likeness.
So you're saying that comes before any of these other identities. I mean, that has primacy over whether you are Christian or Jew or Muslim, whatever.
I mean, all other facets of the identity have been glued or have been stuck onto the real identity of human beings. Look what's being done in the Middle East now between Israeli and Jews. Jews are killing Palestinians, destroying their infrastructure. Palestinians are killing Jews. And the one who is disappearing and not considered at all is the human element in the Jews and in the Palestinians. If they look at that, they would see themselves on the face of the other who is being killed by their own hands. And that might also help to say, well, what am I doing? Committing self-suicide in killing a Palestinian or in killing with a suicidal bomber Jews indistinctly? That is crime against humanity and against myself. I have to stop it.
So how do you try to break this impasse? Everything that we hear these days sounds hopeless.
Well, I founded a school in Galilee in 1982 for only, in the beginning, for our children from that village. But soon enough, I realized that peace is not to be signed only by presidents and prime ministers. They sign peace after they use weapons. We have to write peace, to curve peace, to engrave peace in the hearts of children around the school tables. And there, they need no signature. It's a life involvement. It's a life need to be together. So soon we opened our school for everybody, and we have now over 4,500 students. Majority of them are Muslim, beautiful young boys and girls, very generous, very nice, very ambitious. They want to be human beings like others. And we have also Christians, Druze, and we have some Jewish students till before the present day Intifada. We try to rediscover our humanity.
Now, you said most of your students are Muslims. You have many Christians and Druze as well. Some Jews, or did you say there are no Jews since the second Intifada?
We had a whole class of Jewish kids before the Intifada. They graduated, and because of the ongoing violence and lack of trust and confidence, lack of feeling of security, we have no students now for the time being, but their place is ready, it's protected, it's empty, waiting for them to come. And they will come, because whether they want it or not, they cannot live without us. And whether we want it or not, we cannot live without them. We need each other. We are becoming sick for each other, not sick from each other, but for each other. Yeah.
Do you talk about politics in your classes?
I wonder if we can talk about anything in Israel-Palestine without talking about politics. The problem is not politics. The problem is political parties. Yeah, if you are one-sided politically, that's always wrong. And it has something that is, I think, not right.
But given all of what has happened, let's just say in the last year or so, are students talking about these things in class?
Absolutely. We do not live in an oasis separated from our daily reality. Many of those who were killed are our relatives, our friends, our brothers, our parents, and one of my teachers, Jewish teacher. Well, she had a very bad experience. Her son was stabbed by a Palestinian in the occupied territories, and it was very hard for her. He was a soldier. He has machine gun. But this is very unique case. I don't want it to be generalized or to see that all soldiers are like that. He took his machine gun and pointed it to the girl who stabbed him. He did not fire. And he said to me, when I looked at that girl, she looked so much like my mother, and I could not kill my mother. Okay? There are many stories of cooperation, of mercy, of compassion every day that go on. But here we have to be aware that I am not living in the occupied territories. I'm living inside Israel. I'm a citizen of Israel. The situation in the occupied territories is completely different. It's not only lamentable, it's despair, it's hopelessness. People have no more hope in the future. Their dignity has been always humiliated, their self-esteem broken, and they are dead while still alive.
How do you think about what you're doing at this moment in time when things are so desperate, when the hatred is so intense between so many Israelis and Palestinians right now? I mean, where do you find hope, if you do?
I surely do. You know, Steve, when you have two brothers or two sisters who are fighting each other and you love them and you try to bring them together to closer, the more they fight, the more you are motivated to do everything to bring them together. No, hopeless is not in our dictionary. No, I think ultimately the majority of Jews in Israel, as well as the big majority of Palestinians, are fed up of wars, of violence, of mutual destruction, of oppression, of being dominator or dominated. They yearn to live a human life. And we need to be courageous enough to say, this is possible, come and see.
Father Abuna Elias Shakur is the founder of the Mar Elias Institutions. He lives in Galilee. Steve Paulson spoke with him. And later this hour...
He pumps now, wants to go.
He's
long.
Got him.
A man wide open. Here it's caught at the 35, the 40, 45, 50. He's going to go for the
He's
touchdown.
He's going to go.
The link between football and faith. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We've spent some time this hour talking about the search for harmony among the world's religions. It's not easy to put into practice. But maybe fiction can point the way. This year, Jan Martel won the prestigious Booker Prize for his novel Life of Pi. It's the story of an Indian boy named Pi who survives a shipwreck at sea in a small lifeboat with a Bengal tiger named Richard Parker. Pi gets by on his wits and with the help of faith. He's a practicing Hindu, Christian, and Muslim. Jan Martel told Steve Paulson that Life of Pi is a book that asks a lot from its readers.
What I want to do is push the reader until they're forced to make a leap of faith. Because to me, that is how religion works. Religion is not something reasonable, and we fail to understand religion if we only approach it in reasonable terms. And all religions work by having a degree of implausibility.
Now, it's worth pointing out that in your story, really the middle part of your novel, there is this 16-year-old boy who is out adrift in the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, stranded for 227 days with a Bengal tiger, a great, huge beast, a 450-pound tiger. And you go in great detail as to how this could work. I mean, not only how he manages to, how the boy avoids getting eaten up by the tiger, but how he survives, how he drinks water, how he feeds the tiger, all of that.
Yeah, I want it to be very much a realistic story. This is not a fable. This is not magical realism. I mean, there are small elements that might be called that, but essentially, no, it's an absolutely realistic novel. The tiger behaves in biological ways, and Pi learns how to survive with him. Just to tell readers who just can't believe it at all to start with, I should tell them that right away Pi builds a little raft, which he ties to the lifeboat, so the raft drifts behind the lifeboat, therefore establishing a certain distance between Pi and the tiger.
This boy we've been talking about, Pi, is a wonderful character. He grows up in India, and the odd thing about him, I guess, is that he establishes this hunger for religious faith, even though his parents are totally secular. And he not only becomes a Christian, but also a Muslim and a Hindu all simultaneously.
That's curious, isn't it?
Yes.
The reason I want to do that is Canada is a very, very secular country. And I wanted to talk about religion in an uncynical, honest way. I was looking at mechanisms for living with evil. How do we deal with evil? How do we take it? How do we understand it? How do we live with it? And after all, we do have to live with evil. People die. People die in horrible circumstances. Injustices happen all the time. So I was looking for something to deal with that. And I thought, why don't I have a look at religion? Because for all the flaws, for all the things that are wrong with organized religion, one thing you can say about it is that it does have a very clear perspective on evil. So I thought, okay, I'll look at this. Surely if religion has been around for 5,000 years as far as the Jews are concerned, 2,000 years for the Christians, 1,300 years for the Muslims, surely there must be something grander afoot than mere patriarchy, sexism, etc. So I decided to take them seriously, to pretend I made a leap of faith, to pretend I had faith, to see what was good in those religions.
There's a passage in your novel where Pi explains a bit of his philosophy on faith, and I'm wondering if you could read that.
Sure. It's at the end of chapter 7. This is Pi speaking. I'll be honest about it. It is not atheists who get stuck in my craw, but agnostics. Doubt is useful for a while. We must all pass through the Garden of Gethsemane. If Christ played with doubt, so must we. If Christ spent an anguished night in prayer, if he burst out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then surely we are also permitted doubt. But we must move on. To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation.
Now, I read somewhere that you actually studied philosophy yourself, and that turned you into an atheist. You must have changed since then.
Yes, yes. The only prejudices I had were intellectual ones acquired through my education. And you're right, at university where I studied philosophy, and you know, one of the first things you do in philosophy 101 is look at Descartes' proofs of God, and you cannot prove the existence of God. It's ridiculous. So they're very good exercise to hone your mind. But of course, they're quite mistaken. It's trying to find a reasonable solution to something that doesn't have one. You cannot prove the existence of God by religion. Otherwise, faith wouldn't be called faith, but reason. But so, yeah, at university, I considered myself, I suppose, an atheist. But no, since working on this novel, I've realized that there's much more there than I realized. The texts, the foundational texts, are astonishingly beautiful, deep texts. And I also realized that the question of truth and falsehood misses the point. Faith is a matter of interpretation. It's how you understand life. And that's why I make a very, in this novel, I make a link between religion and storytelling. Religion, in a sense, works like a novel works, works like fiction. A good novel makes you suspend your disbelief. So does a good faith, a good religion. It makes you suspend your disbelief, and we call that faith. And once you have faith, whatever happens to you, you see through that narrative framework of religion. And so doing this research for this novel has set me on a pathway where I do see things in religious terms.
Are you saying that the act of writing this novel turned you into a person of faith?
Yes, yes, very much so. And initially, so my viewpoint was absolutely from the outside, sort of like a zoologist studying a bunch of chimpanzees in the jungle. What exactly do these chimps do? What do these Catholics do? However, bit by bit, the beauty of the text moved me. The beauty of the ceremony. I mean, however awkward the singing may be, it's sincere. We're so cynical in our society. It's so hard to talk about religion, about goodness, about love, about the brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity. In our fast-paced, rich, cynical, glib society, it's really hard to do that. But once you make that effort, once you enter into an area of a space, like a church, for example, where you're allowed to do that, where you can do unreasonable things like fall upon your knees and be seen mumbling little words, once you can do that, you just feel better. I must say, now that I go to church, and I still keep on going, that doesn't mean that I take in everything that the Church of Rome says lock, stock, and barrel. Absolutely not. However, you only truly understand something from the inside. There's a certain nobility to a life where you believe in these grand, grand stories that take our little stories and make them grander. It really ennobles a person to have these, just as in a sense like art does, just as a person who's read Tolstoy and Shakespeare, somehow his soul is ennobled. I believe it's the same thing on an even grander scale if you practice some quote-unquote unreasonable thing like religion.
Now, there's a passage in your book that addresses some of these questions when Pi has been out on the lifeboat for a long time and finally has a chance to think about matters of faith. And now, it's worth pointing out that the tiger has the name of Richard Parker. And I'm wondering if you could read this passage.
So this is chapter 74. I practice religious rituals that I adapted to the circumstances. Solitary masses without priests or consecrated communion hosts. Darshans without murtis. And pujas with turtle meat for prasad. Acts of devotion to Allah, not knowing where Mecca was and getting my Arabic wrong. They brought me comfort, that is certain. But it was hard. Oh, it was hard. Faith in God is an opening up, a letting go, a deep trust, a free act of love. But sometimes it was so hard to love. At such moments, I tried to elevate myself. I would touch the turban I had made with the remnants of my shirt, and I would say aloud, "This is God's hat." I would point to Richard Parker and say aloud, "This is God's cat." I would point to the lifeboat and say aloud, "This is God's ark." I would point to the sky and say aloud, "This is God's ear." And in this way, I would remind myself of creation and of my place in it. But God's hat was always unraveling. God's cat was a constant danger. God's ark was a jail. God's ear didn't seem to be listening. Despair was a heavy blackness that let no light in or out. It was a hell beyond expression. I thank God it always passed. A school of fish appeared around the net, or a knot cried out to be re-knotted. Or I thought of my family, of how they were spared this terrible agony. The blackness would stir and eventually go away, and God would remain, a shining point of light in my heart. I would go on loving.
It's Jan Martel reading from his Booker Prize-winning novel titled Life of Pi. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Later this hour, Mysteries of Faith on the Trail of the Black Madonna. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Searching for faith in America can be a hard way to go. On the one hand, America is a hopping, multi-faith place for the religious. On the other hand, the secular nature of American popular culture can be a spiritual desert. But William Dean says spirituality is alive and kicking in pop culture, if you look closely. Dean is the author of the book The American Spiritual Culture and the Invention of Jazz, Football, and the Movies. He says the origin of American spirituality goes back to the birth of the nation.
Americans, unlike most other peoples, are comprised of people that have been uprooted and thrown into a wilderness where there is not a long set of traditions that they can recognize as their own. This happened even to the American Indian, who was uprooted from his or her society, and to the African American. But all Americans are, in one sense or another, immigrants, even if they're still occupying the land in which their ancestors lived. And this requires Americans finally to be in a position where if they're to have a culture, they have to invent one. They have to improvise one. I moved to jazz because jazz is really, more than anything else, music that is played without a composition, without a long heritage that's given to it on a piece of paper. The genius of jazz is that the players improvise as they go. And it's interesting to me that in America, jazz was born.
You write about John Coltrane, in fact, who was known for improvisation, the great jazz sax player.
I take jazz very seriously. It's not simply a form of entertainment, but it was a form of searching. It's an act of expression that finally is an act that attempts to penetrate the surfaces of the society, to find some answer to the blues, to find some way of coping with the confusions and the dissonances we experience. So yes, I do cite John Coltrane as a perfect example, someone who took improvisation to the heights of, some people thought, making it for its own sake. And near the end of his life, he said, "It's not for its own sake. This is an improvisation that becomes a nullification of music that finally gets at something greater than music."
Talking about John Coltrane, I think I understand what you're talking about. I wonder, though, can you give me an example? If you were to listen, can you hear him search for truth?
If truth really is a recognition that we, at some point or another, have the slate swept clean, that we lose faith in any typical sense of the word, that we experience a kind of everyday atheism where simply the sound of music pretends to be sufficient, I think I can hear that, and I think I can hear him break through that to a grounds for new affirmation. When jazz swings, when it seems to celebrate, when it seems to discover some basis for affirmation, I think I can hear him searching.
Well, along those lines, you've also suggested that maybe one of the most religious areas in American life is football. Now, that seems to be a contradiction.
Yes, it does. I've told the American story in three episodes that we leave some mother country where there was a prevailing set of deep and lasting traditions. And we have occupied as a people what seems like, to us at least, a wilderness. It may not seem that way to the Indians, but to the majority, it seemed like a wilderness. And that we had somehow to gain that land through our own rough and ready acts of assertion. And it seems to me that in one sense or another, football is a ritualization of the taking of land violently.
Fumble!
Fumble ball! Pick it
up! Pick it up!
Down the sidelines!
He's gone!
To the 10, to the 5, touchdown, Green Bay!
Derek Lavelle with the fumble! Newsom picks it up, and the rookie has scored the touchdown for the Packers.
I'll
what a play.
You, what a hit. I'm not sure who hit him, Jim.
Wayne Simmons just
So where is the spirituality in that?
Out of that sort of atheism of the sheer exertion of force, we find grounds for new affirmation in what I'd like to call the third episode of American experience, which is the invention of a culture, the invention of a spiritual tradition.
The violence is not itself spiritual. It is part of the search for spirituality?
That's exactly right. It's a recognition that we are alone, that we have been divested of culture, that we have entered a land without culture, that we tend to rely on just naked aggression as a way of identifying ourselves. But no, in itself, that has no very positive spiritual element, but it is a perfect way, I think, of recognizing that we are attempting to acquire the grounds on which spiritual definition will occur.
Now, the third area in which you assert from American popular culture a connection to spirituality is the movies. Now, I suppose you could say with movies like The Ten Commandments and things that those are a recognition of standard spirituality, but I suspect that's not what you mean at all.
No, it isn't. I've been heavily reliant on two books by a critic named Neil Gabler. He begins in a book written in the 80s entitled An Empire of Their Own, by talking about how Jews invented Hollywood. The Jews had been stripped of their own culture and been subject to radical forms of prejudice. They needed an America in which they had a place. And one sense or another, in the 1930s, they invented a world through their movies. But this invention was accepted by the American populace because it, too, lacked a place. And the movies invented those places. So I do think that the movies had to do with the establishment of a cultural identity and finally, within that cultural identity, a spiritual culture.
So there's something about movies as they are in America. And while they have been created in many other places as well, we do see movies as essentially an American creation. There's something about the way that we use movies to define what? Our fantasies that's spiritual?
Near the end of the book, I refer to three recent movies to try to show how, through fantasy, in some sense, we found grounds for a significant affirmation. I look at the movie Judy Berlin, the movie titled The Truman Show, and The Purple Rose of Cairo, a Woody Allen movie. In all three of those movies, people had become so disoriented that, in one sense or another, the only thing they had left was fantasy. But out of that fantasy, at the end of each movie, they had the opportunity, it was missed in the case of The Purple Rose, but still the opportunity was presented, to define for themselves a new kind of reality. They had an epiphany, a sort of apocalyptic moment where they began to find new grounds for affirmation. So I think you can find this working of spirituality in the movies, even in very contemporary movies.
Just from my memory, in The Truman Show, he is in fact completely unaware that he lives on a movie set.
That's right.
Everything that happens around him is viewed by millions of people, but everybody knows but him.
That's exactly right. And he is surrounded by actors, and there are TV cameras all through this little city where he lives. And he begins to realize what artifice this all is, and that there is no lasting or realistic sense of life in this movie.
Truman. You can speak. I can hear you.
Who are you?
I am the creator of a television show that gives hope and joy and inspiration to millions.
Then who am I?
You're the star.
Was nothing real?
You were real. That's what made you so good to watch. Listen to me, Truman. There's no more truth out there than there is in the world I created for you. But in my world, you have nothing to fear.
But at the end, he looks back at the camera after he's discovered the utter artificialness of the world in which he's been living. And there is a moment of recognition. As the movie closes, you think this man has acquired depths that we didn't expect out of that nothingness in which he's been living.
A suggestion that perhaps in the world we can also find depth where we see only superficiality.
That's right. One of the motifs for my book is what I call the irony of atheism, that the radically secular culture that America is finally has the ironic consequence of leading people to an utter switch. They find out of this naked atheistic secularism new grounds for spiritual affirmation.
William Dean is a professor at Iliff School of Theology and the author of the book called The American Spiritual Culture and the Invention of Jazz, Football, and the Movies. He says he's worried that the spirituality behind American culture is slowly dying thanks to the decline of religious standards.
Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so. That was a lonely teenage bronc and buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. But I knew I was out of luck the day the music died. I started singing bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye and singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die.
Shirley Cunningham knows what it's like to long for meaning in life. She was living in a small town in the Midwest when she felt the calling to become a nun. A few years later, though, she left the convent for good, to search for meaning outside the convent walls. She later married and divorced, but kept up her search for the holy. Cunningham writes about her spiritual search in the memoir called Chasing God. She told Steve Paulson that her later search for God drew her to images of the feminine divine.
I had the opportunity for a trip to the Holy Land. This would have been in the early 90s. And I loved being on the high places of Jesus and Abraham and Moses. I love those high places. But being in the places of Mary, the mother of Jesus, didn't carry that power, strangely. And so I was looking for a way to pursue this sense of the presence of the feminine divine when I discovered the Black Madonna and the Black Madonna pilgrimages.
Can you tell me about them?
Well, I have a great interest in the theories of Jung, and the Black Madonna is an archetypal image, an archetypal figure. You probably could say in some ways even historical figures can assume that type of luminosity. Mary, Jesus, Mary Magdalene, whoever you care to name, as well as many goddesses and gods. And the Black Madonna, the fact of being black, the connection I made was with John of the Cross and the Dark Night of the Soul, the mystery and the fertility of darkness. And we go there in our spiritual lives. We go there many times, probably. Christian language, the death, rebirth, death, resurrection. We have to go into the darkness, and it's not to be feared. The darkness of the womb, I think connecting that to the woman and to the mother is another way to discuss it. Before I went on the pilgrimage, I checked it out with someone else who had gone. And I asked her, what did you really gain from this pilgrimage yourself? And she said, I'm no longer afraid of the void. And that spoke to me. I made the connection with the dark night of the soul. So all that is unknown in mystery, perhaps repressed or suppressed in our culture, much about the feminine divine probably belongs there. Maybe people of indigenous background, blackness in and of itself.
Where did you go to try to see these statues of the Black Madonna?
Well, primarily in France and one in Spain. The one that really stands out in France was Chartres. And, of course, people do associate that cathedral with the labyrinth, which was my association as well, until I found out there is a Black Madonna in the main floor of the church there and also in the crypt.
Now, when you say there's a labyrinth in the cathedral, mm-hmm. this is a kind of a maze where you're wandering around and you're mm-hmm. not sure where mm-hmm. it's going?
Well, the labyrinth is a meditation walk, actually, and it's built into the stones of the floor of the cathedral. And it's not like a maze. There is a path, but the circuits do loop, and some of them take you very close to the center early on. It's a metaphor for your life journey. And my experience at Chartres that really was the outstanding piece there was the labyrinth, not the Black Madonna, interestingly enough. Our group had an opportunity to be in that cathedral alone at night. We lit votive candles, put them around the perimeter of the labyrinth, placed a bouquet in the center. And we had two musicians with us, one woman, a student of medieval music. One of the other women was a singer and had Spanish. So they led us in this beautiful music in the empty cathedral, echoing in the darkness, just our candlelight. It really was powerful. And as we started to walk into the labyrinth, I was probably in the middle of a group of 20 or so, I began. And I had walked a labyrinth before, but I knew this was very powerful. I got part of the way into the labyrinth, and I literally couldn't move. I was paralyzed. I could not get my foot up off of the floor. And astonished, no way to explain an experience like that. After a minute, I thought it was funny, and then I got a little worried, and then I was embarrassed because people were coming behind me. And it seemed in the darkness of the cathedral, what came to me at that moment was, you aren't going anywhere unless I open the door before you. And if you do, it's because I have opened it. So stay with me. And my reflection on it later was that it was like the voice of a very loving mother talking to a much loved but not very bright child. Tolerant.
What was most important to you in this whole pilgrimage in search of Black Madonnas?
Well, in Montserrat, my mother had died the year before, and in fact, the little money that I had from the estate was part of how I wanted to salute her and the Holy Mother at the same time. When I got to Montserrat, this is a most majestic Benedictine monastery on top of mountains that are awe-inspiring, and that chapel is amazing. The statue is a very high point, and everything is very, very ornate. But when you get in there, this seated figure of the mother is holding the child in one hand, life-size figure, and the other hand is extended, holding the globe. And as the pilgrims file by that statue, the devotion is to kiss the hand of the mother. And when I reached that, it was as though it was my own mother's warm, living hand. Again, how do you explain this? I don't. But I'd been trying to grieve for a year and hadn't been able to really get in touch with my feelings. And it was this a dam burst. I was able to finally grieve, and I felt like it was the presence of the loving mother that made that possible for me. And that was really the most important part about the Black Madonna pilgrimage for me, or certainly one of the highlights. And interestingly enough, this was in spring. I sat outside the cathedral, kind of gathering myself together, and there were groups of pilgrims all around. I overheard men's voices singing Silent Night in German. And this is another one of those unexplainable things. Why is someone singing Silent Night in the spring? But my mother's favorite childhood memory that she told me all of her life was her father singing Silent Night to her as a lullaby at bedtime as a child. And every year at Christmas, she invited me to sing that to her. And so I just felt that her spirit had to be present in that moment.
At the end of your book, you say that we all have the power of the Illuminati. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's about light. And right before that part of the last chapter is a little poem that I wrote actually years ago when I was in the Franciscan community. It is silent there and still in that paralyzing presence. Time becomes transparent on the edge of now. Eternity slips through uncomprehending fingers. Is it darkness? Is it light? Being has no dimension, has no hue. Only the blurred outline of a whisper is there, not seen, not heard, but known. Ungrasped, but wholly known, infinite love gives there in the silence of that presence an illuminating embrace. And that's the light that I'm talking about, that we each have that and can access it. In fact, we're called to do that so that we can bring it into our world.
Shirley Cunningham is the author of the book titled Chasing God. She spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Doug Gordon, Ann Strain Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Veronica Rickard, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. If you'd like to order a tape of this program, you can call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for The Fundamentals of Faith, program number 39A.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Jonathan Kaplan is a field doctor who travels to war zones around the world. He treats people who've been shot or maimed. Many of his patients die on the operating table. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, what war looks like from the inside. Also, singer-songwriter Steve Earle talks about political music and his controversial album, Jerusalem. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.